Come in.
New handout, so if everybody has this one, it should be lesson six on the environment. I considered wearing my tie-dye and my necklace and goatee and ponytail. I wondered if you guys had any... Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, from the top. So this has been just a fruitful time of preparation for me and just studying the Word, just because I think there's a lot of things that are unique to everyone's place, time, culture, you know, the fact that I live in Kansas, you know, all those things affect the way I view each issue, and the environment's no different. And so when we come to the Scriptures, it's just been a good reminder to me that that is the key thing that orients the way that we view all of these issues. Okay, so there's kind of an intro here that some of the environmental issues that have come up in the last 40 years, we've had toxic waste, you know, with nuclear power plants, pesticides, that's been an issue for the last 100 years, talking to, you know, many of us have families or are farmers, restricting various forms of pollution, protection of endangered species, looking at the animal habitats, conservation, energy conservation, looking at fossil fuels, recycling, the hole in the ozone, global warming, climate change, and it kind of goes on and on. There's lots of issues that we talk about and we hear about, and it depends on what's going on at the time, how much of that takes a primary role in when we hear about them. But we are hearing about them. So I guess one thing I just thought we would share is, like, when you think about environmental issues or the environmentalists that are in your mind, I mean, what are the things that kind of, this is what I think of, you know, trying to get our mind around, maybe a Christian would think of or just a general person might think of? Alan's grinning. So
there was a story in L.A. when I was there, mm-hmm. where they were trying to extend a road to build a subdivision. To extend the road, they would have to take down this 100-year-old oak tree. And there was a man who basically set up camp in the tree and refused to come down from the tree. Mm. And so you hear tree hugger.
Right. Yeah.
Saving a tree, risking life. And so I think sometimes it's easy to, you know, see this kind of a loony, you know, kind of this loony attachment to Mother Earth, almost seeing it as pagan and, mm-hmm. and earth worship. Mm-hmm. I mean, so there's, I mean, I'm just talking about stereotypes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's something that kind of feeds into how we view environmentalism and mm-hmm. ecological activism.
Yeah. So my non-Kansan perspective.
Excellent.
is studied in Mexico City indicated that basically living in Mexico City is equivalent to smoking 10,000 cigarettes a year. And the normal for us is to shower in the morning and have like black cougars come out. It's just what we have all the time. So on like that side, in an urban center, the issue of pollution and things is much more significant mm-hmm. part of our daily life.
Yeah, it's very real. It seems like it has an immediate impact. Like when some of these issues, like when it talks about the toxic and things, like, remind me of like nuclear testing. There was a time, a couple summers that I spent. One summer I spent in this area in the old Soviet Union in Kazakhstan, and this is near where they did all their nuclear testing. And so they had a museum, a medical museum. And it was filled with two-headed children, all these mutations that happened because of those radiation effects for people that lived miles away from. So that stands out.
Where I lived in Maine, there was a paper mill right next to the Androscoggin River, mm-hmm. and they dumped in the river.
Yeah.
So we weren't allowed. I mean, there's signs everywhere, don't swim in here,
don't
eat anything from here.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad.
I think a lot of times, like where we live,
I mean, since we live around here in the Flint Hills and we don't really experience a lot of pollution in mm-hmm. a lot of, like, so I know sometimes I get the temptation to look at anyone who cares about the environment in big cities kind of as like crazy people mm-hmm. because they're accusing our cows of
right.
causing all the problems mm-hmm. or it's
methane
or our burning pastures. I mean, it's yeah. seems like, you know, for me, I feel like they're always like trying to attack. And if for us, it's like our livelihood, like mm-hmm. can't really help it.
Right.
And so I know sometimes, like, when I hear about it, I kind of am tempted just to brush them off mm-hmm. and be like, well, you're just a crazy person. Go do something else. Like, and I have to
yeah.
kind of take a step back and remember that, no, this is, it is something to be, you know, we mm-hmm. do have to take care of the earth. It is our mm-hmm. job to do that. But there's a balance between taking care of the earth, having a livelihood, and
right.
being a little too crazy.
On the
yeah.
other side of that coin, though, you know, when I walked from the dance studio over to the dollar store, there's masks and all kinds of like stuff all on the ground, you know, just littered everywhere.
Oh yeah.
So at the same time, they might
yeah.
some, you know, environmentalists might be a little crazy, but there is an issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing that's kind of close to home for me is one conversation I have a lot with my dad when I go home is one thing that that does happen a lot around here is the wind farms. And so he lives in an area where a lot of land is just huge pieces of land are being taken up by the huge turbines that there's a lot of questions in their minds about why is this 100 by 100 concrete pad there and why is that helping and is that good for the environment and is it or is it... So they're very passionate about their views that it's not particularly helping. So that's kind of a constant issue, is that sometimes there's action taken that is supported in the name of the environment, but it can be interpreted as being harmful to the environment by the way it affects their that land around here. And you'll notice, you know, north of town, you can just look east and see
yeah.
turbines everywhere.
And I think there's an intersection between environmentalism and economics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that a lot of the environmental movement is about policy and regulation, and it does have an impact on some people.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you put in a policy, there's winners and losers.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess as we get started talking about it, I guess one of the things that we might ask is, you know, should this be something that we're concerned about, or, you know, why or why not? How much concern should we give to environmental issues? So what do you guys, thoughts do you have on that? Bonus points if you want to throw in scripture, but you get deducted if you take it out of context.
I know I worked in the oil field, I've worked in the nuke plants, I've worked in natural gas plants, and the one thing I have found about all the EPA regulations that I've had to follow and had to go through all this training, they're basically just to make it look like they're trying to do something.
Hmm.
A lot of policy, once you actually start looking at it, makes no sense and actually does nothing.
Can you, like, for people that don't, like, explain maybe, like, an example of what you mean by that? Like, I kind of think I know what you mean, but...
Emission standards. We have SIMs for natural gas. It's called Continuous Emissions Monitoring Stations. I was in charge of taking care of those every day. I'd go in, calibrate all of our machinery, make sure it was all calibrated correctly. And the thing that we saw is... as long as we licensed at that point, we could emit that. As long as we told the government, this is what we emit, then they'd license us to that. They wouldn't try to have us cut it back. They just issued the license for us at that emission
okay.
rate. And that's not really...
So it was just monitoring what you're emitting. It wasn't reducing any kind of emissions. And
no.
So that's kind of an example of, like, it's a lot of programs, oversights, laws, policies, but... didn't really affect any kind of change.
And because natural gas is probably the best option, because natural gas, it burns most of it up, and
mm-hmm.
it emits something that's inert mostly.
Mm-hmm.
There's a small amount of emissions that's quote unquote bad, mm-hmm. but it's nothing like, you know, nothing like mercury in coal
yeah.
being released. Where
yeah.
coal releases a lot of mercury into the environment.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's also interesting just the way that you frame the story or hear this these stories, it can be very recognized. She's in tune with her environment. I remember, like you mentioned, natural gas, and I remember seeing a documentary, Gasland, and just the way they frame the picture, you know, they go to these houses where they are people that live on well water, and there's a lot of fracking in that area to produce the gas, and they could turn their faucet on, and they could light it with a lighter.
Oh.
And flame would come out because there was that much natural gas yeah. making it its way into their well water. And so, the framing of the story, they'd present multiple of those where maybe that's 0.1%. You know, you just don't know. And so it's a very persuasive story depending upon who's telling the story. And so it can be.
Interesting story. In Oklahoma, where I'm from, we have had that before fracking even came out.
There you go. See?
But that was something that was, you know, you just kind of accepted that every once in a while a gas pocket will migrate and.
Yeah.
It'll hit your well water once in a while.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we all agree. We all want to live in a place that's clean, where you can breathe the air, where you don't mm-hmm. blow out black in the morning, where, you know, there's not litter, where you don't have to be worried about the water your kids are drinking. I mean, we all want that
mm-hmm.
for ourselves. And frankly, we live in a place where it's fairly easy to have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've lived in a city where there's a lot less that we could do to control that.
Mm-hmm.
And where you are dependent upon regulations
mm-hmm.
by a government to give you a safe environment. I grew up and it wasn't. We had crazy amounts of smog in LA before they cleaned it up
mm-hmm.
through regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we're to prefer others
mm-hmm.
more than ourselves and to love our neighbor as we love ourselves and want for their children what we want for our children, Christians should be interested in that
mm-hmm.
every bit as much as we're interested in, you know, containing COVID or whatever the current
mm-hmm.
thing is that we all agree we should be concerned about. And I think the fact that so many of the people who are at the front lines of the environmental movement are people who hate the Lord and worship the earth,
mm-hmm.
that makes us think that therefore naturally there are political enemies
mm-hmm.
or the things that they want are the things that we shouldn't want.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's just kind of a sinful
mm-hmm.
response on our part and a failure to really look at, is this an issue of stewardship? Is this an issue of love for your neighbor? And what's the best way to achieve that? And we just kind of have this gut reaction of like,
yeah,
don't regulate me in any way.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and so that's a good segue. I think, you know, in the next paragraph on the first page, that says, as Christian citizens, we often fall into two broad camps. And it's not just Christians, but I think that we tend to want to be on one side, one of two sides. And so that's a very dangerous place to be in because it's very unlikely that one side is always going to be on the right side. You know what I mean? Whether it's a political party or whatever. It's, like you said, if you tend to want to be on a winning side versus a good versus a bad, a right versus a wrong, it makes it very hard to really think through individual issues because you're automatically aligned with your group, whichever one that is.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we think about it, you want to try and be focused on the Bible first and not really any particular side of an issue until we know what the Bible says about that issue. So two extremes might be the disposable planet. You know, everything's going to burn, so just toss your stuff out the window going down the road, smoke your 10,000 cigarettes. Or, as it says, drinks the Kool-Aid of the modern environmental movement, fully embracing their agenda. So what we're going to try and do is we'll start at the beginning, and we'll try and see, okay, from the very beginning, what was God's intended role for man on the earth? How do we interact with the earth and with the animal kingdom? What was that like before sin? How did sin change and affect that? How did it affect man? How did it affect the earth? What stayed the same? What modifications were made as we go through creation, as we look at Noah, as we look at the flood? How has that changed, and what role has remained the same? And hopefully that will influence the way that God created us to function on this earth will help form and shape the way that we view the environment. So let's look at this first text. We're going to go back to Genesis 1. So does somebody want to read? Yeah, it's there in your handout, Genesis 1, 26 through 27.
Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created him.
Yeah. Okay. So just looking at that text, you don't have to look ahead if you don't want to. What do you notice? What were kind of the key? Is there any particular key verbs or commands? Do you see anything repeated? What do you notice about just those two verses?
Sets man over animals.
Where and what part are you specifically referring
really
to?
Over the fish to sea and the birds of the sky and over the cattle.
Yeah, so what word kind of appears there multiple times?
Rule.
Yeah, so rule over is given at the beginning, and you see that phrase repeated, over the fish of the sea, right?
Yeah, over.
So we have, right, God creates man, right, and man is to rule over, right? What is he supposed to rule over? Fish of the sea, right? The what?
Birds
of the air. What else?
Cattle.
Anything else?
All creeping things.
Ugh.
It's kind of offensive, isn't it? Cattle and creepy things in the same sentence.
Oh, man.
And all the earth.
Is that in there, right? All the earth. Okay, well, let's get that. That's our... That catches everything.
Yep.
Right? So... Rule, right? Looking at rule can mean to have dominion. Even sometimes can be translated to dominate, to rule over, to reign, right? And what? Let's back up before that, though, right? What's significant? It's that's sandwiched between two things, right? It's kind of the same thing. Look at the passage again. What's at the beginning and at the end? Yeah, we're in God's image. Yeah, and we're in God's... So he says, let us make man in our image, our likeness, and at the end, God had created man in his own image. Right? So he says, at first he says, in our image, then it says, in his image we were created, and then it says, what's the last one? In the word image of God. Right? Image, right? So that's there. Three times we're told at the beginning we're in God's image. We're supposed to rule. At the end we're in God's image. So what does that tell us about our ruling over the earth?
We reflect God's image as we do so.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't say, I've created this creature to rule as they wish. Or to rule in some manly, humanly way. He creates us in his image. Okay, so let's kind of expand on what that means a little bit. There's a quote here that when we're creating God's image, it's not necessarily, if you kind of read down that, talking about different ways that the image of God can be the sense of what that means to be created in God's image. And the differences, that last part, the differences between the transcendent God and mere mortals is so vast that a better explanation might be that you're focusing not so much on big words here, the ontological equivalence, or we're not focusing on who God is in his nature, like his qualities necessarily, but as on some functional comparisons. So how does God function as God of the universe? And if we're representing or his image of that on the earth, how should we function? Okay, as we're here representing him on the earth. So, we're not going very far, right? We're at Genesis 1, 28 to 30. So this is the immediate verses right after that. So right after he says that, someone want to read there 28 through 30.
God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Then God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed, it shall be food for you. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, to everything that moves on the earth which has life, I have given every green plant for food, and it was so.
Okay, awesome. Observations before we go on. What do you notice? What stands out to you? We've just been told to rule. Now we read this.
God created the things that everybody needs. It's already there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's everything that we need. There's food.
Not just for us, but for the animals mm-hmm. too.
So for man and the animal kingdom, he's provided.
It talks about being fruitful and multiplying.
Yeah. So, is that like a, you may be fruitful and multiply if you'd like to, right? Mm-hmm. What does it say?
Be fruitful
and multiply. Is that the only command there? What else?
Fill the earth.
Fill the earth?
Subdue it.
And subdue it, yeah.
What does subdue it mean?
That's a good question. What do you think subdue means? What would you guess? Got a picture of subduing?
Yeah, I think about how there's a plot of earth in my backyard that is to produce tomatoes. And by subduing it, that meant removing certain plants, pulling weeds, and kind of bending it to my will to dominate it, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's producing lots of tomatoes.
Yeah. Now notice that, right, part of subduing it involves what? The weeds, right? Dealing with weeds. Now, it's interesting that, and we're going to talk about it in a second, that he's called to subdue the earth before sin has entered the earth. Before there's any curse on man, plants, the animals, he's still called to subdue it. It could, other uses of that word could be subjugate, conquer, to be the ruler over, right? Which may have kind of a negative connotation sometimes, because when we think about ruling, oftentimes power will corrupt the rulers of this earth. But this is a time before that, okay? We know that Christ rules. Doesn't have to be a dominating, selfish, abusive type of rulership. But there's a subduing command. What were they? They were to subdue the earth. What else were we supposed to do?
Rule.
Yeah.
Fill the earth.
Fill the earth. How do we fill the earth? By being fruitful and multiplying. Okay? And that's an important issue as well. Okay? So when you think about God created this earth full of fish of the sea, birds of the air, cattle, creeping things all over the planet, right? And he's got man and woman. He's got Adam and Eve. And what does he command? Does he command that keep all of this pristine and untouched? No. He wants man to, what?
Fill
the earth and subdue it. Okay? And that's kind of a helpful thing to kind of frame. Yeah.
So one thing about multiplying is it doesn't just mean like the act that it requires to multiply, but it requires then keeping people alive.
Yeah.
So that requires some form of agriculture. Pre-agriculture, they say that without any cultivation of the earth, intentional mm-hmm. cultivation, if we were all hunters and gatherers, the earth could support about 50 million people total on the whole planet. And that's a pretty agreed upon number. And so if we're going to keep multiplying beyond that
mm-hmm.
point, there has to be agriculture,
mm-hmm.
there has to be husbanding animals,
mm-hmm.
there has to be a subduing that's more than just dividing up the earth.
Yeah.
But actually making
it's not earth. Just moving to a place where there's enough trees to pick the fruit off that just
right.
naturally grows.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, a lot of the earth would be uninhabitable if that was the case, or if you only lived where there was
yeah.
growing on the trees that were there already,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't be able to live in a lot of places.
Like
yeah.
Phoenix.
Yeah.
Right. yeah. It's
or
very
you
true.
Only eat oranges.
Yes.
Now, in this word subdue, I have not pursued it in,
sure.
in my studies, but you know, we normally think of it as bringing it under some dominion.
Mm-hmm.
Is it also possible in this with this word? I don't. I'm assuming you've done the study here. That is it bringing it to its fruition or completion?
Like In what sense? Like, what's an example of that word being used in that you would imagine something else being brought to its completion or fruition?
We don't normally, I normally don't think of subduing it that, but bringing it in raw material form, bringing it submission to being able to do much more.
Yeah. I mean, I think you look at the term like domesticate. You know, to domesticate an animal. You know, it's basically to make it useful and functional, which it otherwise wouldn't be. So I mean, I think that's part of it, is we think about leading and dominion as a bad thing, when a good ruler causes its subjects to flourish.
Yeah, so I haven't done extensive study on the, it's a Hebrew word here, kabosh. Usage, bring into bondage, sometimes under force, to keep under, subdue, and to bring into subjection. It can be used both positively and negatively in terms of just treading something down, coming over the top, or just bringing it under subjugation. So it tends to be in the sense of bringing under the control of, whether for positive or negative. It depends on the context of whether or not that's a good or bad subduing, I think.
It's got a lot of its place in Genesis 1, the order of creation. I do wonder if the sense where the Garden of Eden is this perfectly ordered place where Adam and Eve are placed, but the whole thrust of Genesis 1 is God putting order to all of creation.
Yeah.
And so there could be a sense where the world itself, although good, was still to a certain degree disordered, meant to be brought under order by God's representatives.
Very much so. I think so. Sounds good. Yeah. And I think we'll see that more and more too, as it's kind of, we have just such a small window of the pre-fall. And so we get an idea of the commands and the situation before, but it's not long before we have sin enter the picture. And so we're trying to understand, and we'll talk about as well, also there's some scriptural discussion of what it will be like, the earth, the new heavens, the new earth, the animal kingdom after. So we have a little bit of a window before and after the curse of sin to help kind of inform the ideal and what we should be striving for, and then how that's altered and affected by sin and the curse, and how we're to live during this time where God is redeeming mankind.
So I'm wondering, this list of commands to fill the earth and to subdue it and to rule over it really comes after God blessing them. And we think of the subjugation of the earth and the filling of it as a command, but I wonder, is it partly a blessing? Is it this? I mean, and I think our concept of blessing maybe is sometimes a little bit reduced, but it is that a blessing, I suspect, could include a command. But I don't know. I never noticed that followed.
I think part of the blessing is putting them in this, this honored position, right? Yeah. He says, I made all this stuff that makes our jaws drop, and it's all under you.
Well, it seems to, when you think about the blessing, the first child blessing that comes all throughout the Old Testament, you know, that when Jacob wanted Esau's blessing, it was because part of that included the inheritance.
I didn't think about the fact that those are very much tied together, I would say. So his blessing and his command are oftentimes kind of mated together, that this is your what you are to do, and oftentimes the blessing would include that. I will bless you, you are to do this. You will be a father of many nations, or etc. So, very much so, that this, it wasn't necessarily a, here's your job, you know, burdensome type of thing, but more of a blessing.
Well, I think you look at the Abrahamic covenant, I mean, the blessing is children, legacy, prosperity, wealth, and I mean, all of that, being fruitful, multiplying, you know, that's part of the blessing, where before the fall, that was going to happen. You know, the earth was going to willingly yield its fruit and respond to your efforts, you know,
mm-hmm.
and cause prosperity too. So yeah, it was
very
much in line with the blessings we see later on in Genesis itself.
Blessings are absent from responsibilities.
Yeah. Okay, so I thought there's several bullet point kind of questions down here. I thought this one was really good, given that we represent God to creation. So if we're God's image, his representative, and if we're imagining how does God relate to his creation, if we're his representative on the earth, how does that impact how we should treat and value the created world, plants, animals, the earth? What do you think? What are some things or ways you describe that relationship?
If I look at it as we're told to eat the things of the earth, and there are animals that we're called, you know, it's okay for us to eat them. So I think I look at it as like making sure that we're not, when we are having our cows or our pigs or whatever being killed, we're doing it in a humane way. We're not causing more pain than mm-hmm. we need to, doing it efficiently and not, you know, making their lives even like more miserable. I
mm-hmm.
can kind of go extreme on that, but that's kind of how I think of it when I think of doing it in a way that honors the Lord, and that's not
mm-hmm.
not being too cautious with it, but also not being too extreme with it, and just
mm-hmm.
making sure you're being efficient and clean and not causing more pain than necessary.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a very important when we get to later in Genesis when we read about Noah. Because you mentioned, right, animals, right? So originally, what do we read about the food? What's everyone eating for food? Plants, right? And so that's something that we want to talk about when, why, you know. Originally, you know, were there any animals being consumed? Or was that in the very original purpose? Or when did that happen and why? Okay, so that's good. That's good. It's coming up. What else? What do you guys think? How should we treat and value creation because of the way that we are God's image?
I remember when I moved out here and kind of got introduced to hunting culture.
Uh-huh.
And I think, well, you go out and you shoot the animal, and that's kind of the fun of it, and then you kind of eat the, you know, venison to justify it. And the term I heard that was really fascinating is they talked about harvesting game. I thought, huh, I mean, it was just kind of a different way of looking at it,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, this is out there and we're harvesting it like we harvest
mm-hmm.
food. And even explaining that, you know, one, you know, that in some senses, hunting is actually, of all the different ways a deer could die, being hit by a car, devoured by coyotes, or something like that, is actually... So just kind of echoing, you know, some
mm-hmm.
of that is there is a relationship with the earth where it's offered to harvest it, to feed, and to, I mean, see the earth as a gift
mm-hmm.
and a resource.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say a lot of the hunters that I've been around, they have a very high respect for the animals that they're hunting and the things that they're doing. It is not just this, like, I'm just doing this because I have to. They enjoy it, but it's also like they respect the animals that they're, and they see the value in it. It's not,
mm-hmm.
they have a good view of it most
mm-hmm.
of the time, too.
Yeah.
I think when we are talking about we're created in God's image, we're supposed to treat other image bearers, you know, as ourselves. God also created the earth, and he thought that it was good.
Mm-hmm.
He wants us to take care of it, and it's a creation of God that we should care for.
Yeah.
All the animals, all the earth. Like.
Yeah. I think one thing as well is there's a lot of, if you think about just the act of creating, that if you think about artists that creates a work of art, you know, how do they view that work of art? How do they value it? It's something that they find pleasure in. They appreciate its beauty. They don't want it to be marred and destroyed. I think about, for me, just thinking about, as a teacher, thinking about different areas that you can study about the earth, the biology, how you can see, you can see the genius and the in God's design of how he created, like we said, all the animals, the plants, to be able to interact, the exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide, this, the whole system, and just is such a beautiful thing. And that the way that he created it to function, kind of everyone serves a purpose. Everything serves a purpose. And so valuing that kind of role.
I like that idea of an artist, and I really think you see that in Genesis 1 and how God delights in forming and creating. But I think it's interesting if you think of art as a painting, like you hang it on your wall and you look at it. Mm-hmm. But if you think of art as a tractor, mm-hmm. like someone delights in creating a tractor, but that tractor just that tractor is most realized when it's doing its what it's
exactly.
You know, if someone designs a tractor and someone buys it and sets it in their living room and is like, oh, that's a nice tractor.
Right.
Artist is going to be like, wait, well, I
that's
mean,
not
yes,
what
but
it's,
no.
Yeah.
It's
right.
not what I... It's
that's
not...
Right.
My art is not being
that's
realized.
That's right. Ben knows that it needs to be a muddy tractor. He always asks, can I watch muddy tractors? He watches... That's his video thing. He likes to watch tractors in the mud.
Muddy tractors.
But that's true. That's true. I think... you know, being related to and being around lots of farmers, there's such a joy and pleasure in maximizing and bringing a yield from the earth that feeds people. You know, it's just a tremendous amount of work, and to see all the work that goes into, you know, getting 30 instead of 20 bushels or 100 instead of 50, you know, it's just amazing, all the design and the things that man adds to what a field that's, you know, maximized versus a volunteer field that's just left. You're like, well, there's a few plants that might grow.
And like you were saying, with how the ecosystems all work together, mm-hmm. like a lot of times in today's day and age, we are told that as humans, we don't belong in the ecosystems, that we are the problem.
Yeah.
We came into the ecosystems and we ruined it.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to realize that this was all created and God gave it to humans, and we were created in together with the world, you know? It
mm-hmm.
was at the same time. It wasn't separate, and mm-hmm. it wasn't just us pushed into it as something that didn't belong. We belong here, and I think that's an important concept to think of and to realize, because sometimes I forget that when I see stuff. I'm like, oh, but no, we're supposed to be here. We're not
mm-hmm.
just these intruders into the world.
Yeah, that's a common representation, is that there's the earth and everything that's good, and like man is this separate thing that's like this curse or this blight or this cancer that is destroying. So everywhere man goes, he's losing. So that's something that we want to correct biblically and see that man is virtually the opposite of that. He's meant to work, to keep, to guard, protect almost this creation, and to bring it kind of to its fullness. So let's go, let's read a little bit later in Genesis, okay? So let's see here. We are on page 3. So, make sure I don't skip anything there. I think that we're going to look here at Genesis 1:31, right? So this is a quick one. God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. So God's estimation here at this point is
great.
Everything's great. So then we go ahead a little bit later, Genesis 2:9. Out of the ground, the Lord God caused to grow every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food. The tree of life also in the midst of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And so right now, how are things going for Adam and Eve?
Pretty sweet.
Pretty sweet, right? Just God caused them to grow up out of the ground. Hey, food, you know, just walk around. But what I notice is missing is there's no mention of yet, reading to it, the sweat of the brow, the toil, the you're going to return to the dust, frustration. So there's a lot of those things that are missing. But still, I think this is a key, a helpful verse here in Genesis 2:15. Someone will read Genesis 2:15.
And the Lord God took the man and put him into the garden of Eden to cultivate it and keep it.
right? Cultivate it and keep it. So there's two words there. Cultivate, some other words could be to work, to labor, to serve even. To keep, I use it in a lot of places, could mean to watch, to preserve, even to protect. It's the same word that Cain says, am I my brother's keeper, right? His guardian, his protector, his what, right? So we're to work and to keep, or to cultivate and to keep, all right? So how does that influence us? What does that tell you about how we should care for the earth or think about the earth? Becky, you mentioned it a little bit. Like, why is it helpful that we cultivate and keep the earth?
Produce food for everybody.
Yeah.
Like she said, only 50 million could survive without cultivation.
Yeah, and that's people, right? But a lot, and I know a lot of the crops around here aren't used primarily to feed people, right? We also produce a lot of corn that's straight to feed animals, livestock, right? So our cultivation and keeping is allowing and the increase and the spread of both man and the animals. What else do you think? Why is that important? Cultivating and keeping.
I think there's a sense where cultivation implies that by itself it can't be as fruitful as it otherwise would be.
Yeah.
And so for plants in this case to truly flourish, human cultivation is necessary for it. I mean, you look at, yeah, they need bees to pollinate and all this other stuff. There is a sense where the full potential of the plant kingdom is dependent on humans.
Yeah, and this is, again, this is before sin and before the curse. So there's a sense of where we're bringing an order and kind of putting things in a way where it's functioning in its best and its ideal state, in a sense. And so man is playing a part of that, representing God and God's work there.
I think we could keep the earth and without cultivating it. In terms of, like, when I think about a beach in Malaysia, you know, that's littered with 20 million straws, you know, and in one sense, like, are we thinking, like, there's a functional part of of the destruction of destruction that comes with trash, but I think probably I'm just imagining. I have no concrete text here, right? But I can imagine too that an element of keeping the earth, there is an element of delight, and I can imagine like God delighting in our delight, even if there's not a functional, going back to the tractor, like even if there's not a dirty tractor. No, but
right.
I mean, I think that's still an aspect of how God created.
Yeah, I think you could say that cultivating and keeping could include positive and negative elements. There's things that you do actively to cultivate and keep, and there's things that you refrain from doing to cultivate and keep. So there's things that you actively protect and preserve to maintain that the way that they are. You may want to protect and preserve your clean water, and et cetera. But there may be things, actions that you may take to actively make improvements at the same time. Yeah.
I'm just curious. We've thrown this around a couple of times, but we've stated that John, you can paraphrase, is the natural world system could only sustain or support approximately 50 million. Where could I dig that?
Oh, I don't know. Like, you're looking for a source?
Yeah, a source on that one. Because that's less than what we have in the United States.
Yeah, right. Yep. Right.
So if you look at Africa and a lot of other places, you know, where they're not enjoying some of the technology benefits that we have, they're overpopulating that number too. And I'm just not trying to enter an argument here. That number seems ridiculously small.
Oh yeah, I think,
society.
Right, what she's saying is that if there's no cultivation of any kind anywhere on the planet, in a sense, like where would the food, if you're only gathering what naturally grew since creation, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's hard, I think that's a hard thing to say, measure in the sense that we have thousands and thousands of years from the beginning that the earth has been cultivated and that animals have been worked with. And so how do we know, there's a lot of estimation in there, what it would be like if we had a totally uncultivated and
So you look at something like the cultivation of rice that began somewhere around 2000 BC. Okay, so that's pretty long ago.
Mm-hmm.
But you think about how many people live in Asia
mm-hmm.
on rice
mm-hmm.
and have through history, like through our written history time,
yeah.
they've always had rice. So you think about prior to that, what did they live on there? What naturally grows? What naturally occurs there? Fruits on trees.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot in terms of grains and the things that give us most of our calories.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, if you just look at things like that, that's how they calculate it. It's a fairly, I mean, it's just kind of a common number that's out there. There's about 50 million that could subsist on just what naturally grows. The berries, the roots, the nuts. Like, you think about before they learned to cultivate a potato. How many people could live in Ireland?
Mm-hmm.
Before they learned to cultivate wheat, how many people could live off of just the grains that would naturally grow?
Yeah, and one discussion that I hear from friends and family that are involved in agriculture is that it doesn't make sense to them, a discussion about like genetically modified, because all throughout history, man has been attempting to
mm-hmm.
cultivate, right? Everything has been modified. There isn't anything that exists that has not been somehow modified to try and maximize its yield. And so you could say modified since 20 years ago or whatever. But so there's this idea that we there's this essence in which we have a hard time comprehending what the earth would be like without the thousands of years of man's cultivating it and spreading over it over the history of man.
Yeah. To answer your question, John, I Googled care capacity of the world in a hunter-gatherer society. And according to How Stuff Works...
Oh. That's our number one site here.
Caring capacity, they say 100 million.
Uh-oh.
But, you know, whether it's 50 million or 100
no.
million, it's...
Mm-hmm. That's a small number.
It's the same
it's
point.
A small number, yeah.
So you can fit...
Yeah.
make so our conclusion can be in our subduing the world with our technology that we're sustaining...
Yeah.
Approximately, I like for my numbers, 7 billion.
Right.
You know, which is, so you know, kind of a good thing.
Yeah, and the truth is that we could sustain, like when they talk of, we'll get to talking about overpopulation. We could sustain more. It's not that we don't have the food. It's just that it's not distributed to the people that need the food.
Right.
So we have lots of food. Oftentimes we get rid of that food because we have too much, and then we're have surplus. Yeah.
Like when you look at keeping, you also have ideas of for the good of the land itself, you know, burns,
mm-hmm.
regular burning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something that humans have done as long as they've been able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
They say that, you know, the redwood forests in California, one of the reasons they have survived is because Native Americans, as long back as you can see, have regularly practiced burning of those areas. You know, we do that here. It's
mm-hmm.
the same thing. Those are ways that we actually take care of the trash
mm-hmm.
that the earth itself produces, essentially,
mm-hmm.
and return it to something productive
mm-hmm.
for the earth, not
right.
even necessarily just for cultivation. But you know, you think about your kid who brings you a bird with a broken wing. Keeping the earth, right,
mm-hmm.
is what you do with that bird
yeah.
for the bird's sake. We're not eating the bird, you know. But it's just those things too that God He made us as stewards, not merely for our sake,
yeah.
but also because it is better for the earth to have God's representatives live here.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing that just strikes me is that whether you're a rancher or a farmer, they know that you can't just take from the earth. You have to give back to, you have to put different crops in, to put different, you have to put different things in to maintain the balance of that things will life. And just if you, there's been many times where we've just foolishly taken and we've found, that doesn't work. We need to continue to care for it.
Like we learned from the Dust Bowl, and that's why we have so many
exactly.
seeds, right?
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Okay, I think we'll kind of stop there. Next time we'll kind of jump in. We we'll probably get to the sin next time, and the fall of man, and how that affected things. So everything's happy and great right now.